nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Tremendous amount of community, and it's very difficult to think of any semiconductor topic we didn't work on and didn't contribute a lot to that topic. So he graduated from Yale in 91, and he was working with quantum Hall effect and was instrumental in really proving that edge states exist in that material, in the quantum pulse, quantum polar regime. Then he worked with Mark Kostner at MIT and moved to as a young faculty to Berkeley a few years later, and there he worked on quantum dots and contributed a lot in our understanding, nowadays understanding of Coulomb blockade. Later he switched to more exotic materials as, such as organic materials, molecules and molecular conduction, carbon-based materials, buckyballs, carbon nanotubes, and especially after moving to Cornell in 2001, he is primarily focusing on these kind of materials and using various scanning probe techniques, investigating properties of these materials, optics as well. And presumably today he will tell us how to play basketball with buckyballs or with different, how to jump the rope with carbon nanotubes.
Thank you.
The volume.
Those are both passé, so I will tell you about atomic drums instead. So, well, first of all, actually, maybe is there a? Can you bring down the lights?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's better. Yeah. Good. Well, first off, it's a pleasure to be here. I think I was here about the time I went to Cornell and gave a talk here. And an amazing amount has happened in the meantime. There are new buildings everywhere, lots of new faculty. It's very, very exciting and quite a joy so far. I'll also warn you, I'm a little sick today, and I feel like it's starting to affect me cognitively, so this talk might be more interesting than normal. So stay tuned. The work I'm going to talk to you about is experiments that have been done both in my group and actually quite a large number of groups at predominantly at Cornell, in physics, applied physics, and chemistry, and what have you, particularly the Alex Gatiss group, Dan Ralph, Harold Craighead, and Jeevak Parpius groups, by really an army of people who I'll try to mention at least some of them as we go along. Here's some of them standing in front of a nice waterfall. And we're supported by quite a large number of people, including over the years we got a decent amount of money from the INAC Center based here out of Purdue. It was very, very helpful. As well as a lot of other NSF-funded centers at Cornell. We like to play with other people, and these centers are great that way. They reward you for publishing papers with your friends or, for that matter, your enemies. And that's really a great thing about Cornell is all these centers, including, for example, the Cornell Nanofabrication Facility, where most of the samples here were made. The topic will be on these new forms of nanocarbon and using them for all kinds of stuff. As you will see, people are... materials about impact on sciences, solid state, they have connections to everywhere, to all the way from high energy physics to chemistry to mechanics to electronics, you name it. So we'll just take sort of a wander through the garden of possibilities of things you can do with these materials as we go along. Let me start by just making a few general comments. You know, right now, basically standing here at the beginning of a new century, we have two nanotechnologies that are staring us in the face, one of which is the electronic nanotechnology, probably the most sophisticated and complex technology any human's ever made. You can make something with the complexity of a city on something that's about a millimeter in size. That chip will have as many processes in a second as you will think thoughts in a lifetime. It's pretty incredible. So it's an incredibly regimented world where all kinds of little electronic doors are being opened and closed all the time. And very impressive. It's impressive until you compare it with the other nanotechnology that's out there, biology, which really pushes down another couple of orders of magnitude in size and does things completely differently. I mean, instead of having regimented cities where everything is nicely controlled, everything is flopping and moving around, the functional objects are built out of long strings decorated with different groups so that they fold up into useful geometries. Could you imagine designing such a thing? It's a completely nutty world. And the most amazing thing about it is the way that you manufacture is you don't need multi-billion dollar fab lines. You throw some seeds out in the dirt, pour on some water, and let sunlight do the rest. Those of you who work in this field realize that this is a very desirable fabrication technology compared to the competition. Could you imagine that when you needed more samples, you just threw seeds out and let them grow? That would be nice. So we would like to have this technology under our control as much as we do this one. The problem is there's an enormous gap between them in almost every way, intellectually, technologically, materials-wise. This is carbon, this is silicon and related, inorganic, organic. Everything about them are different. You kind of wonder, is there something in between that help us get from here to there? Is there something in between these two worlds that might have some chance of passing back and forth between them that has some characteristics of one and some of the other? And the answer is these nanoforms of carbon have in some sense emerged as a bridge between these two worlds. Things like buckyballs, and for this talk, graphene sheets and nanotubes will be the main subject. These things at one level look like electronic materials that any good semiconductor physicist would know what to do with. You can get metal tubes, semiconducting tubes. You can make them into devices. They're also mechanically very strong. They look like an inorganic material from that point of view. And they can have electronic properties that rival the best things that you can make out of other inorganics. On the other hand, they're truly molecular scale. They're really molecules in a very real sense of the word. This thing's about the same width as a strand of DNA. It's a lot stiffer, but nevertheless of the same dimensions. Graphene sheets are one atom thick. They're really molecular scale materials, unlike the inorganics that we work with. So they kind of bridge the gap, being both recognizable to electrical engineers and vaguely recognizable to biologists. And furthermore, just for funsies, they also have analogies to high-energy physics, in case you didn't like the rest of that story. So it's really an exciting time, the last since buckyballs, I guess, 20 years or so, and another 10 since nanotubes really picked up, and a couple since graphene have started to slowly take over the world. So
can you tell us what those analogies are?
We will. Yes, we will. This is just the warm-up. So. Okay, but first, a warning that you should be a bit nervous. I'm a physicist, and this is a physics department, and here I am talking about technologies. And to put that in context, think of technology as a cow. If you're at Cornell, you begin to think of more or less everything as a cow. You know how physicists view cows. We take the cow, we saw off all the uninteresting parts, leaving behind the pure, sheer essence of cow. You may or may not argue that this is the important parts of the cow or not, but nevertheless. But what physicists do is actually worse than this. And for this, I'll quote Dave Barry, who says that scientists tell us that the fastest animal on Earth with this top speed of 120 feet per second is a cow that has been dropped out of helicopters. So in essence, what physicists like to do, you hand them some beautiful piece of technology like this. We saw off all the bits of it, and then we throw it out of a helicopter and see how fast it falls. And that's basically what we'll be doing in this talk. We'll be taking all this great technology and doing absolutely silly stuff with it. So a little bit of historical perspective on these two fields. I've mentioned it already. There's been about a decade's worth on work on single nanotube transport and what have you, and a couple years on these graphene-based materials. And they're really taking over. I think they will have all journal covers within a couple more years. So it's worth knowing a little bit about them. So let's. Most of the talk will be about nanotubes with a little bit about graphene. But graphene is nothing more than an unrolled nanotube, and a nanotube is nothing more than a rolled up graphene sheet. So there's a lot of commonalities between these. Let's talk a bit. If we are going to be interested in the electronic properties of these materials quite a bit, let's say a word or two about that. Graphene, there's the lattice. There's two atoms per unit cell. I won't say a lot about the band structure. Many of you have probably heard this story before. But basically, there's a valence and conduction band separating between the bonding and the antibonding orbitals. But the fun part is that the bands close at certain points in K-space, so that if you just look near at low energies around the Fermi energy, you get an electronic spectrum that looks massless. There's two little energy versus momentum cones here that if you're a high-energy physicist, you would say that look like massless Dirac fermions. So it's like, electronically, it's like you've got these neutrinos living in this two-dimensional universe that is graphene. And they're left and right-handed in a sense that will become obvious as the talk moves on. The Hamiltonian you write down for it in a K.P approximation just looks like what massless Dirac fermions would look like if you were to write them down in a high-energy theory. The differences are, one difference is that the velocity that takes the role of the speed of light is the Fermi velocity of the electrons in this material rather than the real speed of light, which is about 10 to the 6 meters per second, over 100 times slower than the regular speed of light. So it's like a two-dimensional universe where light has been slowed down to a lower velocity. And these people have wired these things up and measured their properties. I'm not going to say a lot about it because, unfortunately, I was not on either one of these important seminal papers. I'm on this little one hidden down here in the corner. But nevertheless, suffice it to say, people have verified this basic electronic structure in the last couple of years that I just told you about. The analogies to high-energy physics continue if you curl up the graphene sheet and make it into a nanotube. This is the sort of moral equivalent of string theory. You curl up that pesky extra dimension and get a reduced dimensional object, in this case one dimension. And in fact, this really is just basically a simplified version of what Kaluza and Klein did in the very first version of string theory back in the late 20s. You generate, and if depending on how you curl it up, you can generate a massless one-dimensional particle. That would be your neutrino. You can generate massive particles associated with other excitations around the transverse dimension. That, in their theory, would have been, say, the electron. And you also generate higher bands, which would be other high-energy particles, which, in fact, were not seen in experiment, and why this Kaluza-Klein theory was kind of tossed out the window in the early days. But here they actually are all there. There are multiple subbands going on. Again, as I said, the Fermi velocity takes the role of the speed of light, which is, I also mentioned, about 100 times less than c, which, and just something to chew on if you're bored and you like to think, this means that the fine structure constant in this material, in some sense, is on the order of 1 instead of on the order of 1 over 137. A little hint as to what that might mean is, for example, the hydrogen atom binding energy in this universe would be much more relativistic than it is in the current universe. So electrons would be whizzing around inside of atoms. You know, basically, the M0 C squared and the Rydberg would be comparable. So I showed you what a metallic nanotube, if you roll it up in different ways, you can get semiconducting nanotubes. So all the one-dimensional particles that result all have a mass. So there's a band gap in the spectrum with different subbands in the conduction band, filled valence bands down here. The band gap is tunable by the diameter. It's about 0.7 eV over the diameter in nanometers. The effect of mass is also a function of the diameter, as shown here. And the properties of these subbands are that they have this relativistic dispersion that you would expect from quantizing these massless relativistic particles. They're electron hole symmetric, just like, you know, we expect the regular universe is, which, by the way, is unlike your average semiconductor, where usually the conduction and valence bands are derived from different orbitals and so are very, very different in their properties. And finally, they're fourfold degenerate. From regular spin, all the electrons have their own regular spin, plus they have this sort of pseudo-spin degeneracy, this helicity that we were talking about with respect to the massless Dirac fermions. And the physical interpretation of that I'll get to in a bit. Okay, so those are some of the things we might want to see in these materials. How might we see them? Well, one thing we could do is wire them up and measure their properties. And we can attach contacts to them and run currents through them. We can also put a gate nearby and put a voltage on that. That would be the equivalent of populating your universe with excess matter or antimatter. Or if you're a solid-state physicist, we can put electrons in here or holes in here. You can make fancier devices. You can make photocurrent measurements where you can shoot lasers in here and see if they act like solar cells. You name it, you can do these kinds of experiments. For example, what you might see in a transistor geometry is the conductance versus gate voltage starts off as a p-type device, turns off as intrinsic, and then becomes n-type. So here we've got a few holes in the valence band. Here we have a few electrons in the conduction band. And in here, the material is intrinsic. So we can play around with these things like this And people have been doing this for for a decade now.
How do you get electrons in there?
They come in through the contacts, basically. Yeah. You have to have at least one electrode attached to this. And for doing a conductance measurement, you have to have two electrodes attached. And you can do fancier things with multiple gates, back gates, and top gates. You can make devices that have holes in the center and electrons on the outside or whatever. So you can make a PNP, NPN, all kinds of geometries at will. PN junctions, you name it. Yes?
Is there meaning to dope them with some impurities?
Yeah, normally, like in silicon, the way you would make a PN junction typically is you would put in dopants. No one's really succeeded in doing that in the sense of a substitutional dopant that goes into the carbon and replaces it. But if these systems are like wires, there's no need to do that. You just throw gates and do field effect doping. It's much cleaner and nicer and more controllable. So it's not really so important. Let's say that we can measure the conductance. Can we learn a lot about the nanotube from the conductance? And in one sense, the answer is yes, you can learn a lot. In another sense, the answer is no, because of the tyranny of the Landauer formula. Landauer told us a long time ago that the conductance in a one-dimensional system is E squared over H, with a 4 for that fourfold degeneracy I told you about, times the sum of all the different one-dimensional modes through the system. It's just a bunch of transmission coefficients, like you would calculate for tunneling through a barrier. That sounds great. It's really simple, and it relates a scattering problem that you can do from your quantum mechanics course to a conductance, which you can do with voltmeters and ammeters, through this fundamental constant here that has units of conductance. The bad news is there's no explicit dependence upon a lot of the quantities you might be interested in. For example, the density of states of the nanotube doesn't appear in an explicit way, nor does this velocity that I mentioned to you appear in an explicit way. And the density of states, by the way, should be if it's a semiconducting tube, there should be a band gap, and then the density of states diverges when you hit one of these new subband edges, goes back down, diverges when you hit the next subband edge, etc. So this is the kind of band structure we might want to see, and we'd also like to know about the speed of light velocity. Can we measure those from experiments somehow? If so, we're not going to do it with straight conductance. Well, first off, I'll tell you just briefly to measure the density of states, basically how many electron states there are to fill up, you can measure that from the capacitance. So not the conductance, but the capacitance. Because what the capacitance does, it's actually the inverse capacitance, it says how does the electrochemical potential of the system shift as I add charge? That's the definition of the inverse capacitance. That has what you normally think of as the capacitance, which is the change in the electrostatic potential as I shove charge on a capacitor, plus another piece that you don't think about as often, the change in the chemical potential of the system as you add charge. Basically, in a degenerate system, that means that when you want to add carriers into a metal, you have to fill up the next available state, so the Fermi level gets deeper. So there's a kinetic piece and a potential piece to the inverse capacitance. And this one dominates, which is why when you read about capacitors, you always just read about this term. But this one is here as well, and if you make a careful measurement, you can subtract off the big boring background and get at this piece that tells you the density of states. Because d mu dq is nothing more than the density of states with some charges thrown in. So if we measure the inverse capacitance very carefully, we might be able to see this kind of density of state structure. So Shahal Alani, a postdoc who's now at the Weizmann Institute in my group, worked very hard to build a very sensitive capacitance bridge that allowed us to do these kinds of capacitance measurements. And at the risk of going too fast for you to follow, I'll just show you the results. So here's capacitance versus top gate voltage. There's a central region where the capacitance goes to zero. That's when the nanotube is intrinsic. There's no place to put charge. It peaks up on either side, goes down, peaks up again, goes down again. Each one of these peaks is another one of these one-dimensional subbands that we had in the density of states over here. You'll notice that the capacitance is electron hole symmetric. Is that me? No. The capacitance is electron hole symmetric like it's supposed to be, even though, for example, the conductance was wildly electron hole asymmetric. It was a very good conductor for holes and a very lousy conductor for electrons, just because of a property of the contacts. This shows you that a capacitance measurement is really telling you something about the intrinsic material, whereas conductance measurements have lots of other stuff mixed in with them, like how good your contacts are and things like that. So anyway, these measurements allow us to see that there are these multiple subbands that you can fill up with carriers or what have you. And they give you tell you things like the density of states is at a coarse level symmetric. Okay, but now let's say we want to measure some other quantity. What about that velocity? What if we want to directly measure the speed of light in the nanotube? How do we do that? Well, one idea is let's make a finite length of nanotube, and we'll actually do it by making an n-type region between two p-type regions, and just shoot an electron through and see how long it takes to rattle around inside of this thing. That's the most obvious way to measure a velocity, is you define a length and get out your stopwatch and measure the time. The only problem is if you figure out what that should be for a nanotube that's, say, a couple microns long, where the electron can move ballistically through the tube, and for the velocity that we expect to get, that corresponds to a stopwatch with picosecond time resolution. Okay, that's not so easy. Actually, there are ways of doing things at the picosecond scale, or equivalently the terahertz scale, if you like to live in the frequency space. But it ain't easy, and it's especially not easy on little tiny devices that have very high impedances. So we had to work for... Actually, I started this experiment when I was at Berkeley in 1992. So I started it, and nanotubes weren't even known then. So that was pretty cool that I started this experiment before I even knew what the sample was. We actually started it on gallium arsenide quantum point contacts and failed miserably, and then resurrected it and finally completed it too many years later to count. Anyway, just a brief comment about measuring the properties of nanotubes. In principle, you'd like to measure them all over the electromagnetic spectrum. You'd like to measure them at DC. That's easy. I've shown you how to do that. Low frequencies, capacitance, things like that. I've shown you how to do that. On up into the microwave regime, a number of people have made contributions. Then there's a big jump over to the visible regime where you shoot light at things and look at absorption or scattering or what have you. And there's another bunch of work out there. There's a gap in this terahertz regime where we need our little stopwatch. And this is true in most fields of condensed matter physics. There's always a gap in the terahertz regime because you can't go buy a terahertz laser, at least not until recently. And you can't buy, there's great stuff in here and there's great stuff here, but there's not so much there. So how did we do it? The way that we did it is we borrowed some ultrafast technology from optics. Basically, it's easy to buy, if you have, a checkbook that doesn't mind writing $100,000 checks, a laser that will put out femtosecond pulses, very short pulses, or certainly picosecond. What you can then do is hit that onto a photoconducting switch, which is nothing more than some couple of pieces of metal on a transmission line on a substrate that you've applied a large bias across. You shoot the laser down. It shorts these together briefly for about a picosecond and launches a terahertz pulse that goes flying down this transmission line and then runs into your device. So you can whack your device with a terahertz electrical pulse by shooting it near it with a terahertz or with a femtosecond light pulse or a picosecond light pulse. In fact, what you want to do then is do it again. So you hit it with not one pulse but two, and you measure the device response after you've hit it with these two pulses as a function of the time delay between the pulses. It's sort of like investigating the properties of a bell by hitting it once and then hitting it again a little time later. If you hit it at exactly the oscillation frequency, you would get a very different response than if you hit it at something that wasn't equal to the oscillation frequency. Oscillation frequency here being the time it takes the electron to run up and down the nanotube. So the idea is, again, I showed you this before, we hit it with one pulse, there's the first pulse, and then we do a time delay. We basically take a mirror, you split the beam in two and use a little mirror that takes one of them and then move the mirror and that changes the time delay. So we hit it with the first pulse, and then sometime later we hit it with the second pulse. And if we hit it with the second pulse, in this case about 4 picoseconds later, something funny happens. There's another peak. You can also do it at -4 picoseconds because then the first pulse becomes the second pulse, but that's not important. So what we've done is the time it took the electron to do what you just saw there was about 4 picoseconds. Okay. So we've in the time domain directly measured this time. Then you change the length of the sample from 2 to 3 to 5, and you see that the period of this oscillation shifts with the length of the device along a straight line, and the slope of the straight line gives you this velocity directly. So we've done the world's shortest race and measured the velocity of an electron in a nanotube, and the speed of light in this material is, as predicted, about 0.8 times 10 to the 6 meters per second. Sadly, we more or less already knew that, so we don't. It's more the technology that was of interest here than the actual result. If we would have gotten something else, it would have been a surprise. Yes?
My question is the next line in the slide. How do you know it's not a plasma?
Ah, Okay, so we argue that it's not a plasmon here based on nothing more than it agrees with what the single particle prediction says and disagrees with what the plasmon velocity says. The plasmon should be about 3 times this number if G is 0.3. Okay, hang on. So then we wrote this paper and we published it and we said, well, you know, there are some extra little wiggles that are kind of hanging out at our noise. Maybe there's a plasmon in there too. For those of you who don't know about such matters, which is probably almost all of you, in a one-dimensional electron gas, there's predicted to be 2 kinds of excitations, single particle-like excitation that runs at the Fermi velocity, just like an independent particle, and what amounts to a sound wave, a plasmon wave along the nanotube. It's a collective oscillation that should be, for these kinds of samples, a few times faster than that, this plasmon excitation. And these are very fundamental to the theory of the 1D electron gas, and so the theorists in particular love it if you can measure anything related to the plasmon velocity. Because they love the idea that if you put an electron into the system, it splits up into a neutral mode and a charge mode, and they propagate at different velocities, and that's really cool. Of course, the same thing happens when you flick a light switch, and the light turns on much, much faster than it would take the spin degree of freedom to diffuse to the light switch, but we try not to tell the theorists that. Anyway. The net result is we did a more sensitive measurement after we wrote the paper, and we're starting to pick up another period here. You can start to see, you know, it's a little rough and it's a little cruddy, but we're really starting to believe that we're seeing a second period on top of, this was that what we called the first peak. We're seeing a second peak, and from that we can extract this other velocity, and it works out about right. So it looks like the plasmon gives a little wiggle on top of the single particle response. And by the way, that's what probably you would have expected, because in a nanotube, as I said, there are 4 one-dimensional channels. The theory tells you that 3 of them go at the Fermi velocity and 1 of them at the plasmon velocity. So if you don't think too hard, you might think that the 3 would be more dominant than the 1, and you know that you're seeing something like we're seeing is perhaps reasonable. But actually, as far as I can tell, there's no real theory to describe our experiment. Okay, so we've measured this velocity. Now let's go after one other little piece of physics in this system. It's really the same geometry now. We have this electron trapped inside of this one-dimensional box here, PNP-type geometry. But now, instead of doing things really fast to measure things, we're going to go really cold and do spectroscopy on it. So what we were doing was sort of time-domain spectroscopy in a certain sense. Now we're going to do it in what you might call the frequency domain, or better, the energy domain. So we just make one of these things, and now we call it a quantum dot, and we cool it down, and the electrons are now going to live in very well-defined quantum states inside of this quantum dot, and we're just going to measure their energetic properties that way. And I'm not going to tell you a lot about that, but the simple version is now you just do the DC conductance, and as you add electrons to this thing, the conductance peaks up. So, for example, that's the first electron going into the system. And the way it works is, basically, like here, I show the nanotube having no charge in it. If I change the gate voltage so that it's energetically okay for one electron to go on, it can go on. Say it came from that contact. And then it can go away, going to this contact. So that was current flow. And then that process can repeat over and over again, and current flows. If I go past that peak so that one electron is stable on the dot, now no current flows again, okay, because it's stuck there. It's an atom that is stable. And then I can go on up till I have a second electron, and then that one can go off and, you know, go like that, and that would be the second peak, et cetera. And the positions of these peaks then become very explicit and careful measurements of the energy required to put exactly that next electron onto the system. So you just basically measure the energy of these peaks as a function of the voltage you apply to a piece of metal, or in this case, a piece of semiconductor underneath it, and off you go. We can measure the energies of these very carefully. And what should we get based on what I've told you so far? Well, like the lowest level, let's just stick there. That would be a piano string mode where the electron wave looked like that inside of there. But as I told you, it's fourfold degenerate from the spin and the orbital degree of freedom. And in fact, now I'm giving you a physical picture to think of the helicity. Think of the electron spiraling around the tube to the left or to the right. That would be left and right-handed. How do we know that this is true? Like if you believe that there's this degeneracy, you know, we hate degeneracy in this country, we want to remove it. How do we do that? We introduce a magnetic field, and that will split these levels according to the Zeeman effect. Both the spin will split, but also the orbital will split, because if these electrons really are running around the tube, they have some big fat orbital moment associated with that nanometer-sized rotation of an electron. It's a tiny little electron loop running around. And in fact, that's exactly what happens. These are measurements of the first, second, third, fourth electron as we turn up a magnetic field, and then this is minus, so it's mirror symmetric. The first electron goes down in energy because it's both got its orbital moment and its spin moment pointing the proper way so that they both lower their energy. The next one actually goes up for a while and then down and then et cetera, et cetera. So we're measuring basically how these different levels move in magnetic field. And from the slopes of these lines, you can infer both the orbital moment, which we measured in a paper that we published a few years back now, and also the spin moment. And what we found was something kind of interesting. Let's talk about the very first electron that we put on there. That's simple. We put one electron in this box. We should see a fourfold degeneracy of states that should all split once we turn on a magnetic field. So that's so look, here's B is equal to zero. So that's right in here. This is the action part. So there are four states, one, two, three, four, and they're all splitting like you might expect. There's only one problem. They were actually already split into two pairs of two at B is equal to zero. They weren't degenerate. That was a big fat lie. Sorry about that. They were split. And why were they split? Well, you know, this is a blow up of that region, so you can see that they are split. They are split. And there's a big hint as to why they're split in this view graph, and it's this blue thing that says delta SO on it. Okay, so it must be spin orbit splitting. That was the key. If you look carefully in science, you'll always find a little symbol telling you what the meaning of things are. In this case, this tells us that this was the spin orbit splitting. The spin degree of freedom, the irregular electron, and the orbital motion apparently are coupled in this system, which is something that most people weren't expecting, that you would have spin orbit coupling in nanotubes. In fact, people had been very excited about nanotubes because they didn't have spin orbit coupling. The spin degree of freedom was completely free, and therefore you could make a really wonderful quantum computer with it. Okay. Don't get me started as to where the problems are in that statement, but nevertheless, the one thing that you have to realize now based on these experiments is indeed there is spin orbit coupling between the electron in there. So why is that? Well, let's remind ourselves about spin orbit coupling. Let's say we have a carbon atom. That's what the system is made of. And we have an orbital that's spinning around like that. Okay, the electron spinning around like that, the spin of that electron sees the proton running around it, and that generates a magnetic field that gives you the spin-orbit coupling. It's very small in a carbon atom. It's about 10 millielectron volts because carbon is not very relativistic. The fine structure constant being what it is, the splitting is small. But again, it comes from the fact that this orbital is spinning around, and that gives the spin-orbit coupling. What about a nanotube? Well, a nanotube, you've got orbitals spread all the way around the diameter of the tube. What happens when an electron makes a circle around the tube? Well, there's an electron. Let's say it's there, and now it's going to make the circle around the tube. Oh, it actually rotates, right? You know, when it goes around, it rotates around once every time it makes a trip around the tube. So it's sort of, if you don't notice the fact that you're living on a cylinder, if you just think of yourself as that electron there, it looks exactly like this, except now you're spinning at a slower rate. You're spinning at the rate at which an electron runs around a nanotube instead of spinning at the rate at which an orbital spins around its nucleus. So if you want to know how big the spin orbit splitting should be in this experiment, you can roughly speaking take the ratio of those two numbers, and it gives you more or less the right answer. Whoops. And then it can go around the other way too. So that gives you that splitting. It's kind of interesting. Carbon by itself had spin orbit splitting. You made it into a plane and you quenched the spin orbit splitting because the orbital stopped rotating, right? They're all sticking up like that. Then you wrap it into a cylinder and suddenly they start to rotate again. You can tell because I tore out my shoulder trying to show you. So in fact, you get this spin orbit splitting for the first electron in the system, which again was surprised. And this was published by the heavy lifters on this were again Shahal Alani and Ferdinand, I can't pronounce his last name, Quemeth, who's now at Harvard. They did an absolutely phenomenal job on this, and they just would come in and tell me the story, and I had very little to do with it. So even more than normal, all the credit belongs to them. One last little thing about this that's kind of fun. This is the first electron in the system. Here's the first hole in the system. So this is, you know, looking, you know, down here. One thing you might ask is this spin orbit effect still electron hole symmetric? And the way you test that is you turn the whole one over. That's what electron hole symmetry does. You flip everything over. So plus charges become minus charges. And now you see that actually they're not symmetric. First, the gap is a little different, but also the splitting. In this case, these are closing. In this case, they're going apart. So in fact, in this universe, there is not strict electron hole symmetry, because when we turn our band structure over, we really haven't gone in and changed the electrons to holes in some sense. We haven't gone in and replaced all the carbon protons with electrons and all the electrons with protons and stuff. So this is a case where it remembers the high energy structure. You know, it remembers what's going on at a much higher energy scale. Okay. All right. Whew. Boy, that was exhausting. We should take a break and visit our cow again. By the way, what time is it?
It's dead.
Good. Not too far off. Okay, so back to our cow. Well, I'll just show you the quote. Who was the first guy that looked at a cow and said, "I think that I'll drink whatever comes out of that when I squeeze it"? That was Calvin, not the philosopher, but the Calvin and Hobbes Calvin. The idea here is that, okay, so now we've looked at the science of cows a little bit here, this technology that was allowed us to play around. Now let's think about what's going to happen when we squeeze it. What might you do with these nanotubes or with graphene in addition to just studying the science of electrons living in them, their fundamental properties? So let's squeeze the cow and see what happens. In the last few years, we've tried to do a lot of different things with carbon nanotubes and with graphene sheets, using them as artificial bio stuff, using them as nanoelectrodes, using them as solar cells, or using them as very, very tiny musical instruments. And I'll hit not all of these, but some fraction of these as we go along. And just to give you a flavor of why these materials might be fun for things other than themselves. So first, let's start these days everyone wants to hear about solar energy. Can we make nanotube solar cells and solve very, 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 very tiny energy problems? Okay, how do we do that? Well, first we need to make a nanotube p-n junction. Here's a nanotube. We put a couple of gates underneath it in this case. We can put different voltages on these and dope holes over here, electrons over here. You've seen this motif before. This is the simplest kind of thing you can make, a p-n junction. Honestly, it's really a PIN junction, so you make a nice long depletion region so that there's not a lot of tunneling between the source and the drain. Other people did this first. And then you measure the IV curves of this, and you get a very nice diode behavior. So there's the diode IV curve. Looks like a diode. If you didn't know any better, you would think it was made out of geranium or silicon or something. And you can cool it down and measure the temperature dependence and what have you. And there's a few odd things, but, you know, at least two-thirds of it makes good sense, and you can infer from these kinds of measurements the band gap of the nanotube and the ideality factors and what have you. The important thing for us will be that there is this band gap, which sometimes I will call E11. That means it's from the first conduction band to the first valence band, E11. In principle, there are other subbands like E22, which is the next one of those, which will come up in a minute. But for now, this thing that acts like a diode. The minute you have a diode, you can make a solar cell out of it. All you have to do is shine light on it. It's a very, very small solar cell, so we would like to make a very, very small spot of light. So we focus the laser down as best we can and shine the laser onto it using a not too complicated cryostat and optical setup. And we shine it down, and for example, if we scan the laser around, we get a big photocurrent response right exactly when the laser is over the nanotube, the center of the nanotube, the p-n junction. So in this case, this is an image of the current generated by the solar cell as a function of the position of the laser spot. So we scan the laser spot around, and whenever it's in this region, which corresponds to this region, we get a big response. Most of this work, by the way, was done by Nathan Gabor, who's an absolutely fantastic graduate student. And what happens, of course, is that you create an electron, you take an electron in the valence band, you knock it up into the conduction band, leaving behind a hole. These separate in the built-in potential of the p-n junction, and you collect the electrons on one side and the holes on the other, and that induces a current in an external circuit. That's how your solar cell works. So far, so good. One of the surprises happened when we did this more carefully. This is just the same kind of thing I was showing you before. Now we localize the laser right over the p-n junction. And this is actually done at low temperatures. This is the current versus source drain bias. So here's the IV curve like I showed you before. That would just be the turn on of this transistor, of this diode, I should say. Now, as I I turn on my light, and then I turn on more light and more light here, what you see is you see this photocurrent response. So like at zero source drain bias, you're getting a current that's growing with the power. That's what a normal solar cell would do. So if I just showed you this part of the graph, this would look like a solar cell made out of germanium or anything else. What happens, though, is you start to go to negative bias, which corresponds to reverse biasing this p-n junction, making it bigger. You start to see extra steps in the photocurrent. See, there's that thing there and then that thing there. So there's some extra steps occurring in the photocurrent that's happening as you reverse bias the p-n junction more and more. Furthermore, here's the data I was just showing you. You can take the derivative of that and turn those steps into peaks and then measure the distance between those peaks and then do it for nanotubes of different diameter. And what you find is that these steps scale with the size of them changes with the diameter. And in fact, the size of the step exactly agrees with what you expect for the band gap of the nanotube. So every time you see another one of these steps, it's because you reverse biased the thing by one more band gap. Okay? So, well, why is that? Well, once somebody tells you that, the obvious thing is that what happens is you create this electron hole pair. They accelerate in the potential of the p-n junction, get enough extra energy to impact ionize another electron hole pair. So they run along and they create another electron hole pair. So this is, you know, this is the same thing that happens in ionization that happens in an avalanche photodiode, for example. So that's in and of itself not strange. What's strange here is that it happens immediately. It happens as soon as there's enough energy. As soon as it gets one more band gap of energy, it goes bam and turns itself into another electron hole pair, which you then collect. That's the interpretation. So this system is kind of funny. If you give the electrons excess energy, they turn themselves into more electron hole pairs. In a regular diode, what they do is they turn themselves into more heat, typically. They emit phonons and things like that. So they throw the energy away into vibrational degree of freedoms. Here, they generate more electron hole pairs. So that's kind of interesting from a lot of perspectives. One is that, you know, you might be able to make good avalanche photodiodes out of it, but that's probably the least interesting thing. It's important to, well, one last bit of data. This is an unpublished story that is not, you don't have to trust all of it if you don't want to, but we think it's exciting, so I wanted to tell you about it. You only see this process, you only see this thing happen if you shoot in a laser with an energy such that you create the electron hole pair in the second subband, not in that first one, not across the small gap, across the second gap. So you have to create an E22 electron, that means one that's in the second subband. Then you accelerate it, and then that relaxes, generating, we don't know which, either it relaxes and stays an E22 electron and creates a lot of other electron hole pairs, that's version one, or it just relaxes all the way back down to E1, to the bottom and creates N plus two electron hole pairs. But in either case, what you're doing is taking a high-energy electron and turning it into a lot of more electron hole pairs. Your device is making change in a certain sense. You know, you're giving it $2 and it's giving you back two $1 bills. So it's conserving energy, but it's giving it to you in a lower denomination, which you might say, who cares? Well, who cares is the solar cell people. If you can do this, you can make a much, much more efficient solar cell. Because if you put in a, right now, if you put in a photon that's twice the band gap of your silicon solar cell, half that energy is lost to heat and junk and bad stuff, and then you only collect one EG worth of information of energy. If what we're telling you is correct here, these might do better. They might be able to make change. You could put in a photon energy of three band gaps and turn it into three ones and then collect it all. So they might be much more efficient and change the game in terms of the potential for solar cell efficiencies. Now, there's a long way to go to prove that this might be that this would happen in a real solar cell for sure. And even that the science is correct, as I've outlined it to you, you should be skeptical. But there's really a lot to get one excited here. And you might ask, well, why? Why the heck does this happen here and not in other systems? And there's a lot of ways to say it, but I'll say it in the particle physics language, because the fine structure constant is 1. Basically, what that means is that the Coulomb interaction, the electron-hole interaction, the scale of that is the Rydberg, right? The scale of creating an electron hole pair across the band gap, that's the rest mass of the electron in the hole. So that's like the relativistic scale. The alpha equal 1 tells you these scales are on the same order. So basically the Coulomb interaction effects are on the same order as the M0 C squared or M0 VF squared effects. And so it's very you're in a strongly relativistic limit. Pair production is not a hard thing to have happen. The way you would say that in solid-state physics language is that the electrons in the holes in a nanotube are not embedded in a high dielectric constant. They're not sitting in epsilon equal to 10, which screens the heck out of all the interactions among them. You've got this charged particle flying along on this nanotube string that's more or less sitting out there in air. So it's just charged as heck, and it's not screened, and so it's much more able to interact with other charged particles and create electron hole pairs. So we think this is potentially very exciting, and we hope to sew this thing up and write a paper about it real soon.
Also, electron photon must have to do with this. Also, the peculiarity, the strength of electron photon coupling in this case, myself said, you know, the study must go also with the photons.
Well, you bring up an excellent point. And if the electron photon coupling is too big, it's bad because it just sucks away all the extra energy. On the other hand, you may need some phonons to clean up your momentum conservation issues as well. For example, if you particle physicists know, an high-energy electron won't spontaneously just start spitting out electron hole pairs because it can't do it and conserve energy and momentum. But you have phonons that may, you know, they may extract a slight transaction cost every time you want to do one of these processes. We aren't accurate enough to know that yet, but it still may go. The bulk of the energy may get transferred into other electron hole pairs. People in this world are very excited about this possibility of these sort of electron hole pair multiplication in nanotube quantum dots. People are seeing evidence for this in other systems, but not one where you're actually collecting the carriers. Okay. Now I have 10 minutes. Okay. We're trying to use nanotubes as bio stuff, and I'm going to skip over most of that, other than to say that we're not alone. Lots of people are trying to do this. And to give you kind of a sense of where the state of the art is, as a year ago for us, by these two guys over here, one from my group and one from Harold Craighead's, is we can take, for example, a nanotube and press it up against a lipid membrane and see what happens. So here's a lipid membrane on the surface. There's a lipid membrane. There might be something attached to the lipid membrane. And this is still a transistor for us. We can be measuring it and playing around with it. And at the same time, we've got it right up within a few angstroms or a few nanometers of some interesting biological system. In this case, biology's version of a 2D system. And we can do molecule detection using it as a transistor. I'm going to skip over that. And we can also see if, like, membrane proteins bound to the membrane, can they flow over this perturbation, or does this thing act like a speed bump? And so what we do is we flow fluid and try to make these little sailboats sail over this nanotube bump. The molecule in question was tetanus, which makes you do that if you get it. So it would be nice to have a tetanus detector, which is why you study tetanus. But we don't care. The bad part of the tetanus is gone here. This is not deadly, and I don't think I have tetanus. That's a different thing than jaws lock up. And clearly my jaws are not locking up. Anyway, we flow the proteins that are labeled fluorescently by, and they, in fact, they do get hung up on the nanotube. They can't quite make it over, but then they finally fall over and dribble downstream. So we've made what amounts to, mixing my metaphors horribly, speed bumps for sailboats. And in fact, I won't show it to you here, but the amount of speed bump it is depends upon the diameter. If the tube is 3 or 4 nanometers in diameter, it stops it entirely. If it's 1 nanometer, they sail over just fine. And you may think, well, that's stupid. What does this have to do with anything? But it turns out in your cells, you have a scaffolding that sort of supports the lipid membrane. There's a bunch of spectrin and actin filaments, little filaments that are floating up there. Guess how big they are? They're, you know, 2, 3, 4 nanometers. And in fact, it is believed that they play important roles in segregating the lateral diffusion of membrane-bound proteins. So this may be a physicist's version that allows us to tell the biologists things that they probably don't care to know, which is what we live for. Okay, last thing. Graphene membrane. So finally get back to unrolling a nanotube and doing something with graphene. Two quick things I'll tell you about. Graphene resonators, which is a work that's published, and nanochambers, which is work that is submitted but not published yet. Given the short time, I'll probably skip over the resonators pretty quickly. You probably get the basic idea. We've made in the past, by the way, Cornell guitars and all kinds of other dribbling buckyballs. We love to make things move, but we didn't have any percussion instruments per se, so we went for drums this time. Although this actually looks more like a xylophone than a drum. The way we make these samples is this very complex and sophisticated technique called writing. You take a pencil, actually an piece of graphite, rub it over a surface, and if you get lucky, some of the graphite pieces peel off and are single sheets in size. You can use things like Raman spectroscopy to tell you how many layers there are, and then once you've got this thing, you can try to make it vibrate. And the way we do it is we load it into something in the Craighead Parpia lab, which is basically a big fancy optic setup. The sample sits in there. A laser beam comes flying down on the graphene sample. One laser excites the vibration, You just turn it on and off at the resonance frequency, and the thermal contractions cause it to vibrate. Another laser comes in and measures the deflection just from the change in the absorbed light as it moves up and down in the laser field. So it looks complicated. It's not that bad. If you're an optics person, it doesn't look complicated. So you can be doing these experiments your very own self with not that much money. Again, if your checkbook doesn't mind writing $100,000 checks. Anyway, you do this. So this is amplitude versus drive frequency. We're flashing that. And you'll see a big giant resonance and then a bunch of little resonance. So this is the fundamental mode where the thing's going up and down. You can measure the Qs and what have you about it. And it's not that great of a resonator. The Qs are on the order of 100. But it's pretty cool because it's like a one atom thick. You know, that's pretty neat to make a paper sheet one atom thick and it still vibrates and does all that stuff. So it's more of a gee whiz thing to make a resonator from a single sheet of atoms. The next thing we decided was, by accident, we made some samples that had alignment marks that were holes. And we made graphene that covered the whole hole, so to speak. And that made a little sealed nanochamber. And so my student showed me the thing, and I kept pointing at the alignment mark, saying, that's cool, study that. And so they did. So you take the graphene sheet, the hole, and you put the graphene over it. Now you got a little sealed chamber in here. And now if you pump it out, what's going to happen? Oh, well, now you've got one atmosphere across a one-atom-thick membrane. It's going to puff up, right? Okay. Assuming, of course, that a one-atom-thick membrane can hold vacuum. So that's the question. That's the last question we'll answer in this talk. Can a one-atom-thick membrane hold vacuum? Let's take a vote. Who thinks a one-atom-thick membrane can hold vacuum, say, longer than a day? Who thinks there's no way a one-atom-thick membrane can hold vacuum more than a day? Who has no friggin' idea one way or another? Fine, good. That's the best kind of experiment, right? Okay. So let's see what the answer is. So anyway, this is schematically what it's all about. And there's various ways we can measure this membrane and see what's going on. I'll mention the first way is we can actually do this, measure the resonance frequency when it's vibrated. Now it's got a little air pocket underneath it, but it's vibrating. If it really is under tension, it'll be vibrating at a high frequency because it's like all stretched, right? It's like a taut surface of a balloon. So then we put a little more air in the outside world. That's this faint stuff that you see here. And we measure the resonance frequency again, and it is dropped. And then we do it again, put a little more air out here, and the resonance frequency is dropped again. This is the external pressure, okay? And then we do it a little more, and it drops more, and I guess that's the balloon. So we can control the resonance frequency, and this is a huge effect, right? This is factors of 5, the resonance frequency, by changing the differential pressure across the membrane. So for at least the time of this experiment, we kept a larger pressure in here than was out there for a while, which is at this moment on the order of hours, say.
You say stretching. Is it bond stretching, which is very unlikely, or is it just that it's getting unglued on the edges?
So it's bond stretching because you can reverse it. It goes back.
Okay.
It's actually not stretching that much if you work it out. In fact, in the pictures, it'll always look like it's stretching a lot. But it's really the fractional stretching is like less than 1% by a lot. In fact, you can use this effect to measure the pressure inside of the nanochamber explicitly. If you change the pressure, you'll go through a pressure where the membrane has no net pressure across it and then comes back up again. In fact, we do this again over different times. Just cut to the chase. Take this blue curve. It went down to a minimum and came back up again. This thing here, 300 millitor or 300 torr, is when the interior and the exterior pressures were matched at that particular moment in time. Then you wait a while. The chamber does leak, and this minimum pressure changes. Okay. So there is some relaxation time for the system that's on the scale of hours to days, depending upon the gas. Okay. That actually doesn't tell you whether the membrane is leaking or whether this is leaking, right? Because SiO2, glass leaks, certainly leaks to, you know, helium and stuff, and leaks to other things as well. So we still don't know who's the biggest leaker, but I'll tell you more about that in a minute. First, just if you don't like all these frequency shift things, you can just take pictures. So, in fact, this case, we loaded it up with 6 atmospheres, put it in a pressure vessel, and then return it to 1 atmosphere, and it puffs up. And then you take an image of it with an AFM, and it just looks like a big puffed-up ball. Although this axis is wildly exaggerated. Just makes for cooler pictures. Here's one where we have an atmosphere on the outside and nothing inside, and now it goes down. This is actually a single graphene sheet, this one. So this is about 1 atmosphere of pressure across it. And then over time, it slowly relaxes back over the course of a couple of days. It slowly relaxes back towards its equilibrium value. So the leak rate is on the scale of days. And this one was with air inside. We've also done it with helium, argon, you name it. By the way, the analysis of the mechanical problem associated with this, you can pull out the Young's modulus and things like that. You also pull out something interesting, that even when it's back to no pressure difference, it actually is self-tensioned. It sort of wraps itself around the edge of the hole and then is like a tension membrane across the hole with a surface tension on the order of about 0.05 newtons per meter. So it self-tensions itself quite a lot. So it's under a little bit of strain already. It's like a little trampoline, even with no pressure difference. Because of the van der Waals interaction between the graphene and the oxide, it likes to go down. And you can also measure the spring constant of this with an AFM and pull out this thing as well. So it's kind of cool. It's really a 2D membrane that's 1 atom thick, and it's got a reasonably well-defined surface tension. So all you membrane people out there, you can just start applying all of your ideas to graphene membranes now. The last question, which is, well, what's really leaking? And the answer is, it's leaking out here. It's not leaking through the graphene, even for the one. And I tell you that because we measured samples of various thicknesses, so various numbers of layers of graphene over here, and it basically didn't matter. It was leaking through the walls. Furthermore, you can look up the leak rates through glass and make estimates, and it's about the right scale. So it's really leaking through the walls. So in fact, a single graphene membrane does not leak, even helium, not even helium. And you may say, well, that's amazing. And then you spend, 5 minutes doing the WKB approximation, and the transmission should be 10 to the minus 100 or something like that. And then you say, okay, maybe that's reasonable. So, by the way, all that story we tell, that if you run into a wall enough times, you'll tunnel through it at some point. It's a big lie. Even for helium, even if the wall is a graphene membrane, you're going to wait a long, long time before you get through that wall. So don't try that experiment at home, kids. Anyway, with that, I'll stop. We're thinking about what to do with these membranes. We have no idea yet, but we're playing around with various things. With that, I'll just stop and, again, thank all the people involved and to thank you and the cow. So thanks so much. There's a guy's website who basically plays with steel and like quick cooling things, and they're not single graphene membranes, but he gets graphite bubbles off of a ball, because graphite is a waste product of steel production, because it's basically, that's the catalyst particle, and it goes out on the surface. But anyway, you take those and you cool them down, and sometimes weird stuff happens, and you can get blisters, basically.
Machining little pits in the silicon so you don't have a leakage problem, then you could have a permanent supply of gas in there and make devices that kept their properties.
Yeah, excellent point, because Si, unlike SiO2, should be very impermeable to almost everything for the same reason that the graphene is impermeable. We tried that once, and it leaked a little bit, but we think there was crud on the surface. You have to clean it up quite a bit. So that's a very good idea, and we need to work harder on it. It's actually extremely convenient that it leaks on the scale of one day, because you can set the pressure set to some value, you just leave it there for a day and then you come back. But we plan and have even made initial attempts to do what you suggested.
I've got a question about some of the fabrication of the devices. So you use lithography to use PR MMA masks, you mentioned you can measure conductance versus capacitance, the conduction measurements of errors in the contacts. Have you looked at the different lithography masks to figure out what kind of polymer gives the lowest error in the conductance measurements?
So you're saying, what's the best way to do the fabrication? The fabrication is always a bit of a lot of magic, and there's a problem with nanotubes. They're really great and they're strong and they're wonderful, but the one thing they don't stand up to is all the standard semiconductor cleaning procedures like oxygen plasma, because from the point of view of silicon, a nanotube is organic crud. It's goop, it's junk, and it etches in oxide. So all these wonderful cleaning recipes we all have for making silicon devices you can't use. And so residual crud that gets between your nanotube and the electrodes is a huge problem, which is what you're getting at. We don't have any particularly good solution other than what everybody else does, and I wouldn't even know. If you're welcome to contact my students or postdocs or even me, and I'll point you to the right one, and they'll give you their insights, but those are probably more valuable than my own.
there has been a lot of papers on this exciton in CNTs, and you didn't even mention the word exciton. But you talked about increased Coulomb interaction in 1D. And I also saw that you use this 0.7 divided by D as the band gap, which is coming from early 90s from optical experiments, from what I understand, you know, using this tight binding band gap. If you include the exciton binding energy, the actual electronic band gap is expected to be larger. And there's been quite a bit of PRLs on this aspect.
A very good point. You know, every time I was saying the Rydberg in these is really big, I was basically saying the exciton binding energy is really big too. So I was using, I never went into the optics world and the optics language, but everything you said is correct. The 0.7 EV number is sort of an average that can come from various places, and some transport measurements also suggest around 0.7, and our diode measurements suggest around 0.7. You're right that the exciton energy is whatever your band gap, you know, your free energy is for your electron and hole. The exciton is quite a bit lower than that, but probably 0.7 is somewhere between the exciton binding energy and the free band energy, something like that. It's very interesting, too, to ask questions like in those simple, straightforward diode measurements when you're pumping electron-hole pairs, are you collecting huge numbers of excitons in the junction? We might be. We don't know what that would look like because nobody's ever thought about it before, because in silicon, it's such a small effect you would never notice it. So in fact, you know, we think hidden around are various really interesting excitonic effects, even in places other than just straight optics. But we're just starting to try to figure out, you know, to zoom in and understand what those might be. But this impact ionization effect is sort of an exciton collision effect or something. Yeah.
It seemed to me it would be very interesting to look at the electronic property of this graphene bubble. Now you have a controlled way to introduce a curvature.
Yeah.
That's
correct. And you have to decide what you want to do with that curvature. In fact, one thing is that spin orbit scattering emerges from curvature in graphene. But if you calculate how big it would be based on the size of that curvature, it's negligible. But you can do it. You can strain the material uniformly. It's also very disorder-free and doesn't have any wrinkles. So there's a lot of interest in the 2D properties of graphene, and a lot of people are worried about whether it self-wrinkles and whether it's crumply, which would change the electronic properties a lot. This gives you a way of creating a nice, stable structure, although if you cool it down, it's gonna deflate and stuff. So we think it does open up a lot of interesting doors for allowing you to muss around with the electronic properties, but we haven't done so much on that yet.
Why is it, if you back up about three slides, we have one where we're at the van der Waals and sidewalls. On the bottom left, I assume that's an AFN emission.
Yes.
But it drops down, and then from there, the curvature goes
what
I would call positive again.
Yeah.
It's seeming under vacuum, right?
So this one, we've got the atmosphere on both sides. So it's one atmosphere on both sides. But still, why is it puckering up? These images are a little bit tricky, because what actually happens during the imaging is you go down and you touch, and in fact, the graphene membrane can stick to the tip, and it can oscillate with you. And suffice it to say that interpreting these images is quite tricky. And I can actually change the set parameters and get images where the graphene membrane sticks up. So what it's doing is it's pulling it out every time. So I wouldn't take that too seriously. I don't believe that that's actually there. I think that's probably a manifestation of the difference that the tip interacts with the side of the membrane near a wall versus the membrane in the center, if you know what I mean. It would make sense. It's floppier in the center. Yeah.
Early on, you had some pictures of, I guess it was a kind of ballistic resonance, and there were some secondary peaks, and then there were some little bitty ripples that looked like slower stuff. Do you interpret that structure as meaningful?
No, is the short answer. We don't have the courage to interpret. The measurement is reasonably noisy, and so a lot of that is just plain old-fashioned noise, not reproducible. When I say noise, I mean if you did it the next day, it wouldn't look the same way. Like this little tiny stuff, I would ignore. I go in there every once in a while, and I'm saying, ooh, that little tiny stuff, that looks really cool. And he kind of laughs, and then we take it again, and it goes away, stuff like that.
Okay, let's finish this picture again.